Welcome to Breast Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Mark Robeson from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York, who at the recent ASCO meeting presented a landmark plenary paper on the results of the Phase 3 Olympiad trial comparing the PARP inhibitor olaparib to chemotherapy in patients with BRCA germline mutations and metastatic HER2-negative breast cancer. Of course, with three PARP inhibitors now approved in ovarian cancer, there is accumulating experience in clinical practice with these agents. And to begin, before getting into the data, I asked Dr. Robeson about the toxicity tolerability issues with these agents and olaparib in particular.
There clearly is myelosuppression, and it appears to be that anemia and thrombocytopenia are the most clinically relevant. I think you do see sometimes a little bit of leukopenia, neutropenia, but febrile neutropenia is vanishingly rare. And it's also extremely uncommon to have to delay or reduce because of leukopenia. The challenge has been that many of these patient groups have been pretty heavily pretreated. And particularly in the ovarian space, they've been heavily pretreated with platinum, which of course has essentially a hematopoietic stem cell toxin is kind of a little bit of an issue. And so I think one of the things that moving forward we need to sort out is what are the predictors of clinically significant anemia, clinically significant thrombocytopenia? Is prior exposure to platinum, particularly in the breast space, is that a relevant predictor or not? In Olympiad, we had a fair amount of anemia. We had a significant amount of grade 3 anemia, like 16% grade 3 anemia. About 18% of the patients wound up getting a transfusion at one point. Whether that was truly because it was clinically significant anemia or because there was a hemoglobin requirement to continue on trial and people were just trying to push people up so that they didn't have to interrupt the drug, I don't think we know that yet. And it will be interesting to see whether or not, especially in the breast space, there's an overlap with prior platinum exposure.
What about these GI issues?
Yeah, so, I mean, I can only speak to it from the breast space, but most of the nausea and vomiting was actually grade 1. And, I mean, you've done clinical trials like I've done clinical trials. If you're sitting there doing your tox assessment and have you felt for the last 4 weeks, have you ever been nauseated? Yeah, you know, I had some nausea, and they're grade 1 nausea. I have personally had some patients, though, who had pretty significant nausea and required antiemetics. It tended to get better with time, and dose reductions and dose interruptions were relatively uncommon on the Olympiad trial, and dose discontinuations for nausea were essentially non-existent. There are certainly patients who have nausea and need antiemetics, but it wasn't that much of an issue for most of my patients.
That's good to know. Why don't we just sort of walk through what we know right now in terms of clinical research with PARP inhibitors, and particularly with the Olympiad trial. Maybe you can just sort of summarize what we knew about olaparib specifically in breast cancer, BRCA germline, and other prior to the Olympiad data.
The answer is not much. I mean, there were two basically small trials. There was the Iceberg trial, which was Andrew Tutte's study, and that was a phase 2 study looking originally at 400 milligrams twice a day, which was the now FDA-approved dose in patients with germline BRCA mutations. And, you know, that had about a 40% response rate, overall response rate. And then it's interesting, there was an additional cohort that was added, 100 milligram BID cohort was added. It was not a randomized phase 2 dose comparison trial, but the response rate was lower in that arm with, again, relatively small number of patients. Then Karen Gelman did a study in triple-negative breast cancer, including BRCA mutation carriers. And in that study, the patients who did not have a BRCA mutation essentially did not respond. And the patients who did had a decent response rate, but it wasn't particularly well maintained in that study. And that was, aside from some phase 1 data, and then study 42, which was Bella Kaufman and Susan Domchek's study of patients who had been heavily pretreated, that was pretty much the sum total. So certainly there was indication of response, but, you know, again, heavily pretreated cohorts by and large.
Of course, you know, ovarian cancer is a very different disease than breast cancer, but, you know, really the incredible finding that came out last fall with niraparib, that basically people who are HR even negative benefited from the use of a PARP inhibitor in that situation. really talked about the biology of ovarian cancer. Is there any reason to believe that PARP inhibitors would be helpful outside of people with BRCA germline or maybe other germline similar in breast cancer?
You know, so far, the only data that really looked at that was Karen's study, and it was a small trial that was not encouraging. The challenge with HR is measuring it. And so, although I agree with you that the NOVA trial did show benefit in patients who didn't have that particular biomarker, it was pretty clear that the benefit was greater, you know, substantially greater in people who had BRCA mutations who kind of have the ultimate knockout of their HR capability and was more intermediate in patients who were HR deficient by the assay. So while, yeah, there was a benefit, it was much more marginal. And you sort of wonder if that was more a failure of the definition of HR capacity than it was necessarily benefit outside of that space.
Although, I mean, the hazard rate was like 0.5. So, but I guess you could imagine within that group, there might be people who didn't benefit whatsoever. But anyhow, I guess, again, high-grade serous is not the same as infiltrating ductal cancer of the breast.
No, and also you have to remember that all those trials, all the ovarian trials really have been maintenance trials, right? So they've all been patients who are largely, I mean, rucaparib study, Ariel is a little bit different, but the other two, you know, both NOVA and the olaparib trials were patients who were predefined as being essentially platinum sensitive. So they were really selected, or at least not platinum refractory, let's put it that way. And yeah. So they were kind of pre-selected for potentially being responsive.
Oh, that's a really good point. Yeah, like maybe if you took breast cancer patients who responded to platinum, you'd see the same thing. I don't know.
Well, anyhow, there's actually a trial. That trial is being done, actually.
Really?
You know, yeah, Kim Blackwell and Rebecca Dent are doing that study.
What's the design?
To try to give a run-in of carbo and then for responders randomized to placebo versus continuing a PARP inhibitor.
Wow.
So following a similar thing. And that's a trial design that Andrew Tutte actually has been pushing for years. So I'm glad to see it's finally getting done.
Is that in triple negative?
I believe it is in triple negative.
What would you guess just you would see in terms of response rate to a platinum triple negative?
You know, Steve Isikoff's data sort of suggested around 20%, 15 to 20%. So
anyhow, let's talk about the Olympiad trial. Maybe you can talk about the design of the study and what you found.
So this was a pragmatic trial, just because back when we were trying to figure out how to study PARP inhibitors in breast, we had a very, very difficult time coming up with something that would be acceptable to everybody, and certainly we couldn't replicate the ovarian experience. So we took essentially the EMBRACE design and took folks who had anthracycline taxane-treated disease, HER2-negative, germline BRCA mutation, and had two or fewer prior lines of chemotherapy, randomized 2-to-1 to the tablet formulation of olaparib versus physician's choice of capecitabine, eribulin, or vinorelbine, with a PFS endpoint of, you know, primary endpoint being PFS, and targeting a hazard ratio of about 0.63. So we were looking for an improvement from a baseline of about 4 months in a control arm was the predicted PFS. And then we had to get 230 events, and so we randomized 302 patients and wound up with what you saw, which is a hazard ratio of about 0.58 as a blinded independent central review.
I think that one of the numbers that surprised me the most was the response rate.
Yeah, 60% response rate overall versus about 20% in the patients who were getting conventional chemotherapy. But I think when you look at the control arm, I don't think any of us who treat a lot of breast cancer would be particularly surprised.
No, absolutely.
The number.
60%. I mean, were you expecting that?
No, that was better than we expected. I mean, remember in Iceberg, it was about 40% for the 400. So that was probably a slightly more heavily pretreated group of patients. So. But it was quite nice to see 9% complete response rate and, importantly, no difference in response rates between the patients who had either triple negative or hormone receptor positive disease, which was a nice backup to the subset analyses.
How about adverse events?
Largely the ones that we've been talking about. I mean, really the main issues were nausea, vomiting, anemia. Those were the big ones. And in chemotherapy, as you would have expected, it was neutropenia, a little bit of nausea, LFT abnormalities, and hand-foot syndrome from the capecitabine. So no unanticipated toxicities. You had mentioned earlier MDS-AML, no cases of MDS-AML. And I think that the MDS-AML story hopefully is going to become not exactly moot, but I think we're going to get more and more reassurance as more and more patients are treated.
So one of the questions that this leads to of tremendous practical importance relates to mutation testing. Mm-hmm. And before we get into kind of what you think might be standard at this point or would make sense, I'm curious about another issue that, again, we've been hearing about in ovarian cancer. And you mentioned rucaparib. The approval for rucaparib actually, if I understand it correctly, is not just germline, but also somatic BRCA mutations. And there's an assay coupled with it. You had a paper at San Antonio last December on somatic gene alterations, BRCA gene alterations. What did you see, and what do we know right now about somatic mutations? And, of course, the issue, do they respond or they benefit from PARP inhibitors?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think we need to figure out exactly what the proportion of patients is who have somatic mutations in BRCA1 or BRCA2. We have an abstract from our group that's going to go in from our impact data suggesting that it's relatively rare. Certainly much less common in breast than it is in ovary. Part of that, of course, being the overall heterogeneity of breast cancer. And there may be subsets of breast cancer that have slightly more, but it's not going to be 10, 15, 20% of patients with somatic mutations in BRCA1 or BRCA2. Will they respond? Well, I mean, we'll find out. There's a couple of trials that are getting ready to start looking specifically at the question of responsiveness, both in the setting of somatic BRCA mutation and, as in the prostate cancer experience, in the setting of mutation, germline mutations in other genes like ATM, PALB2, RAD51C, RAD51D. And so Nadine Tung is going to be leading, hopefully, a TBCRC study to address that specifically in breast cancer, and there are other efforts underway in other diseases.
And obviously, there's a lot of discussion in ovarian cancer about what kind of testing to do. I've heard some people say do somatic testing first and then back into germline if you want to. From a practical perspective, certainly a lot of people in practice are sending off, you know, next-gen sequencing in all kinds of patients, including breast cancer, particularly, I think, triple negative. When they start running out of options, you're saying it's not that likely, but if you see in this testing that there's a BRCA germline mutation, would you attempt to utilize olaparib?
Well, what you're going to find on tumor-only testing is if you do find a mutation, you have to figure out whether that's germline or somatic. And so you would then need to reflex into the germline testing to define it. And until there is a kind of label, if you will, for somatic mutation in the breast space, I'm not sure that that's necessarily going to be the best strategy. On the other hand, it may be more feasible to get reimbursement for somatic testing than germline testing of a low probability patient. For instance, you know, some older patient with hormone receptor positive breast cancer who's going to have a low prior probability of germline mutation doesn't fit NCCN criteria or whoever's criteria for germline testing, it might be more feasible to test them somatically. I think the real key there, though, is going to be to make sure that people follow it up, because if you don't resolve the germline issue, you could potentially leave something on the table for the family, which is something that wouldn't be ideal.
So you mentioned the NCCN and other guidelines about BRCA testing, but to me, that's like history now. You tell me, it seems like any patient who's got metastatic HER2-negative breast cancer needs BRCA germline testing, regardless of age, regardless of anything, I would guess, at least from, I'm not sure exactly when, but certainly at some point, I would think. Would you agree with that?
You know, I think that if somebody's coming up as a candidate for therapy, it's going to be difficult not to do it. I mean, this is a very challenging space right now because this collision of germline predisposition with therapy, and how do you decide who's right to do testing and what's the appropriate process for that as well, is something that's pretty disruptive. And I think that that's a good thing, I think, to take it back out and look at it. But we're working right now with what we call mainstreaming approaches, which is ways of providing clinicians with educational materials and, like, you know, videos and consent materials up front so that they can do the testing. And then we in the genetic service are hooked in on the back end so that we can follow up if they're positive. So getting rid is unfair, but turning the pretest process into more of an education process than a choice process. But how to do that at scale across the country is going to be interesting.
Can I drill down on what you're trying to get at here a little bit? Because I'm not entirely clear. It kind of seems like there are two issues. One is the therapeutic issue from the point of view of the patient, that there's essentially a biomarker to predict a treatment that's got a 60% response rate that they would want to know about. But then the implications to the family. And isn't there a way that you can divide that up a little bit? In other words, I would assume there may be situations where family or patients don't want to know from a counseling perspective, but clearly they would want to know from a treatment perspective.
Yeah, and so that may be the case, I think.
I mean, is that what you're trying to get at with the disruptive?
No, what I'm trying to get at is that all of genetics has been set up that, you know, this is personal utility information, right? I mean, the whole model that we start with has this idea that when we first began testing that the information was just for people to know for personal reasons, not necessarily for medical reasons. And that model has obviously changed over the last 20 years. And this is kind of now the peak of that, right? Now it's, as you said, a therapeutic biomarker. So we have to readapt our model so that people get this information. But also we can't neglect the implications for the family. And we have to make sure that that information gets out to the family because, yeah, they're all focused on therapy and that's totally appropriate. But on the other hand, if their daughter now is at risk for developing a bad disease, they also need to know about that.
So are you saying that you think maybe in clinical practice there are people who are getting BRCA tested, they're found to be BRCA positive, and they're not getting genetic counseling?
I don't know that to be the case, but my concern is a little bit of what you kind of alluded to earlier, is that when people are getting this for therapy in the middle of, you know, obviously the devastation of having metastatic disease, if they deprioritize the implications for the family, then their family members might not get the information in the way they need to. If the patient's sick, busy dealing with being sick, it's like, yeah, okay, later on I'll tell my family, but they need to know this. So I'm just worried about how we're going to set up the – worried is not fair. I think we have to think about how we're going to set up the model to make sure that the people don't fall through the cracks.
I'm going to say telemedicine, tele-oncology could probably help a lot, but just my thought about that. I've got to tell you about a great case that we had at ASCO in our GI symposium. These were cases from practice. So we had a general medical oncologist from Pennsylvania, gets this patient, comes in, 60s, who's got metastatic pancreatic cancer. So he actually gives us this detailed pedigree that he wrote up, and his patient's got all these cases of cancer in the family. So he sends off, and the patient's got a BRCA germline mutation. And, of course, the patient's got metastatic pancreatic cancer. He's going downhill. The patient has a 35-year-old niece who is BRCA positive, is now being considered for prophylactic surgery. And just the, you know, the astuteness of this oncologist, because this patient got pancreatic cancer, perhaps the life of this woman was saved. I mean, it's an amazing case.
Yeah, no, and I think we're seeing more and more of that. I think there's more and more understanding that these germline mutations and, you know, BRCA1, BRCA2, Lynch mutations, and certainly others are being found in people who would not have been tested based upon existing criteria. And how we work that into our model is going to be very interesting.
Incidentally, the last two prostate cancer symposia that we've done, one was the AUA, the other was at GU symposium, I asked the faculty, do you do BRCA testing on your patients with metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer? And Howard Scheer was one of them. Every single one of them is doing it, and every single one of them is using a PARP inhibitor if they're positive, and almost all of them have cases of patients who responded. Which really leads into my question. You mentioned the MSI thing, which is really, I think, the first approval that was kind of based on a biomarker and not on a tissue type. Do you think that's where we're heading with BRCA and PARP inhibitors? You know, again, you're seeing people use it in prostate cancer.
You know, that's a really interesting question. And I think that that is going to be a complicated regulatory science issue. And how to get the FDA on board with that, I don't know who would take point on that, but it makes sense. We're seeing responses to PARP inhibitors in individuals with germline BRCA mutations in many different settings, and you hear anecdotal ones in even more. So it would be logical for this to be a pathway-driven type of approval. But how you set up the designs that the FDA approves that is not clear to me.
So I'm wondering if we're going to get beyond the topic of PARP inhibitors and BRCA before the end of this interview, but there's so many other things I want to ask you about. But one is the practical implications of this Olympiad study to patient care. You would think that this is changing standards. So, I mean, I guess you would have the issue of the patient with ER-positive, HER2-negative disease and sort of where hormone therapy would fit in, CDK4/6 inhibitors. Mm-hmm. How do you see this actually coming into practice? How's it come into your practice?
Well, I mean, I think that the results for hormone receptor-positive patients have been so stunning with the CDK4/6 inhibitors, particularly in first line, that I don't think there are data to throw that away for this yet. And so it would start there. We're talking about developing some studies to look at combinations of anti-estrogen CDK4/6 inhibitors and PARP inhibitor to see if that's tolerable, something we can drive forward. But for now, I think the results have been good enough that I would do that. And then think about a PARP inhibitor instead of chemotherapy, sort of when you get to the point that you're starting to think about chemo. In triple-negative disease, you know, one of the things that was very gratifying to see in Olympiad was that the time to response for the patients was similar in the patients who got olaparib compared to those who got conventional chemotherapy. So this wasn't something that worked slowly. If it was working, it was working quickly. So the big question, I think, in triple-negative disease is going to be the role of PARP inhibitors versus platinum-based agents in the BRCA group. If it was up to me, I would feel like a PARP inhibitor was kind of a lot more tolerable than a platinum and would go that way. But whether or not one is going to be better than the other is going to require a trial that I'm not sure is ever going to get done. But numerically, the responses are pretty similar in the TNT trial and the Olympiad trial. So I think it's a reasonable option to try to avoid IV chemo for those patients as well.
Do you think it would be a reasonable option in a younger patient who wants everything possibly to be done to give platinum therapy short-term and then olaparib as maintenance outside a trial setting?
Again, it's an intriguing idea. The sensitivity, cross-resistance is incomplete between platinum and PARP inhibitors. There's definitely overlapping mechanisms of resistance, particularly in the BRCA mutation carriers. But conversely, I think sensitivity to platinum has in other settings overlapped with sensitivity to PARP inhibitors, so that would not be an unreasonable thing to do. You know, trial of platinum followed by a maintenance with olaparib. Of course, that's going to be so completely off-label that you're not going to know what to do with it, but it's a sensible clinical approach. On the other hand, I wouldn't feel like I necessarily had to start with a platinum. I felt like the results are similar enough between Olympiad and TNT that I would feel pretty comfortable in most patients with triple-negative disease beginning with olaparib, and if you get a quick response, then you've done that with an oral agent, and that's a good thing to do.
Could you just briefly summarize what the TNT study looked at?
So the TNT study was, again, Andrew Tutt did the study over in the UK, looking at patients with triple-negative breast cancer randomizing to either get carboplatin or docetaxel as first-line therapy for metastatic disease. And the responses overall between the patients who got docetaxel and carboplatin were pretty similar in the triple-negative group as a whole. But in the group of patients who had germline BRCA mutations, relatively small pre-planned subset, there was an advantage with the overall response rate was 68% in the carbo arm and down in the 30s in the docetaxel arm. And there was also a difference in PFS. And all of those numbers were pretty similar to what we saw in Olympia.
Any rationale to continue a PARP inhibitor on disease progression and add something else in?
I don't think so. I think the mechanism of resistance to PARP inhibition, there are several. There are a number of different ones, but all of them would compromise this synthetic lethality. Basically, they all reestablish homologous recombination. And given that, I think the likelihood that you're going to derive benefit from continued therapy is pretty small. We did clinically, again, and completely anecdotally, there were patients who technically progressed according to RESIST criteria and yet were felt by their investigators to be continuing to derive clinical benefit. So either very slow progression or progression in one site with continued disease control in other sites. So I think in that setting, it might be okay to, as we all do in clinic under other circumstances, kind of hold off from changing until it was pretty clear that there was significant progression.
What about, and you see this with targeted therapy, you know, doing local therapy, you have one lesion progressing, you radiate it, you take it out, whatever, everything else is that a strategy you ever use?
Yeah, I think that that's, again, a perfectly reasonable strategy. Now we're just talking about kind of clinical oncologic medicine. I mean, one of the most common mechanisms of progression or resistance to PARP inhibitors appears to be reversion of the mutation. In other words, there is a clone of cells that has somehow managed to reestablish an open reading frame, to reestablish homologous recombination. And if that only occurs in one site or two sites, then directed therapy towards those sites might be fine. The problem is that these cells are so genomically unstable that it tends to happen in multiple different sites, and so multiple different clones arise with different revertant mutations. So evolution is tough to circumvent.
That's really interesting. Do you see if you can get rid of those cells with, say, chemotherapy or whatever, do you get clinical sensitivity PARP inhibitors back?
You know, I don't think anybody's actually tried that I know of to re-challenge. But unfortunately, that's also a setting where there's frequently resistance to platinum-based agents as well. So if you have somebody who's anthracycline taxane resistant, progressed through platinum, progressed through PARP inhibitor, unfortunately, the likelihood that they're going to respond to other therapies is going to be...
I want to find out a little bit more about how this plays out clinically. I want to hear about at least one of your cases here, maybe this 49-year-old lady, but just any sort of pearls of advice to somebody who's about, maybe has not used the drug, olaparib, and you're about to start it in a patient with metastatic HER2-negative breast cancer, particularly about how to deal with anemia. I've heard the gynecologist say, if the patient's responding, we transfuse and just keep going. What do you do about dose reductions? What are some of the common clinical issues that come up?
You know, so as we talked about a little bit earlier, the two most common issues are nausea, which is often worse at the beginning. And I think that giving people appropriate antiemetics and trying to kind of carry them through that, and hopefully with some encouragement, that it will generally get better with time. Sometimes it takes a couple of months, but it does get better. And then with regard to the anemia, my sense is that if the anemia develops, it develops quite quickly. And so I think a little bit of earlier monitoring for anemia, even though it's an oral drug, perhaps checking it 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, just to kind of make sure that the bottom doesn't drop out. And again, my hypothesis, although without any supporting data, is that that might even be something you want to particularly do in people who've received prior platinums. And then if it drops, I think you would use your conventional transfusion threshold and your judgment about whether or not somebody is receiving clinical benefit. And if they are, and you just need to give them a unit every now and then, or even put them on an ESA to kind of try to keep them propped up, then you're still deriving the other benefits that are avoiding chemotherapy.
You know, when you ask people to bring cases in, and it's natural to try to bring in people who've done really well, but, you know, sometimes you can learn a lot. You don't have to see too many people who do really well to, particularly on a monotherapy, to get my attention. And this 49-year-old lady sounds amazing. What happened with her?
She's my poster child. She really is. So she was on Andrew's original iceberg study. She was actually the first patient that I put on it. Actually, she's from Miami. She flies up to see me from Miami. And she didn't have high volume disease. She had relatively low volume pulmonary disease, but clearly had progressed through anthracyclines, taxanes. It had a chest, had a wedge resection, progressed through CAPE, progressed through Veno. And she has tolerated the drug incredibly well, has never had any significant toxicities, and is just chugging along essentially NED at this point. I mean, every time I see her, I'm like knocking wood, but she's doing great.
I'm not sure we mentioned yet that this was in December 2007.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's 10 years with
10 years.
Clearly documented metastatic disease refractory to multiple chemotherapy regimens. So, you know, it's interesting. If you look across all the trials, there are a few patients like this in treated with olaparib. I mean, and of course, there are a few patients like this with any chemotherapy drugs. So you can't make too much of it. But there's even been an effort to pull together these extreme responders and see if we can find any predictors. I did exome sequencing on this lady's primary tumor, and I couldn't find anything that was different than what you would normally see in a triple negative patient. But
did you look at her immune system?
No, I haven't actually done that. I mean, but she was just a straight up conventional BRCA1 founder mutation, triple negative disease. There was nothing about it that was unusual except for her dramatic and prolonged response.
I was going to ask you before, because I see you've done a lot of work. Really, I see this paper in Nature Medicine just recently, the mutational landscape of metastatic cancer, 10,000 patients.
Well, that's been Mike Berger's work.
What do we know at this point, though, about the, you know, I guess, the mutational landscape of breast cancer?
I think we're learning that there are certain recurrent mutations in different disease types. There's a little bit of correlation with histologic subtype. So, you know, you see P53 mutations in patients with triple negative disease, of course, PI3 kinase and ESR mutations in hormone receptor positive disease. I think that breast cancer is not as hypermutated by and large as some of the other types of cancers. You don't really see the kinds of things that you do with Lynch syndrome or mismatch repair deficient colon or endometrial with their hypermutator phenotypes. And so we found a few pragmatic targets, and people are certainly trying to leverage those. And at the same time, looking at more complicated types of genetic abnormalities like fusions, you know, rearrangements, and some interest now developing in epigenetic types of abnormalities to see whether or not those might provide something that's a little bit more tractable, druggable.
Just to finish out with PARP inhibitors, what other trials are out there right now, particularly phase 3 trials that, you know, we're going to be looking to see some results on, particularly in the earlier stage, neoadjuvant, adjuvant setting?
So I mentioned the EMBRACA trial, which is the talazoparib phase 3 in essentially exactly the same design as Olympiad, except it's a little bit larger. It's trying to power it for an overall survival advantage. Then there is the carboplatin paclitaxel, with or without veliparib study that's being done in triple negative disease with veliparib. And then I think in the early stage setting, there's Olympia, which is a adjuvant trial in relatively high-risk patients who have germline BRCA mutations, so either residual disease after neoadjuvant therapy or significant number of nodes involved. And then a number of phase 2 trials, kind of a let-the-flowers-bloom type of approach for using in combinations with IO and in combinations with other targeted therapies. There are some studies that are being done in combination with conventional chemotherapeutic agents, but I think by and large those are perhaps a little bit less exciting. And then some correlative studies trying to understand the biology of response and resistance a little bit better.
So in the Olympia trial, they can get adjuvant chemo, adjuvant hormones?
Conventional adjuvant chemo and plus minus hormones if that's appropriate. And then the randomization is for the PARP inhibitor on the back end.
But HER2 negative?
Correct.
And then how long do they receive the PARP inhibitor for?
That's a year.
A year.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think that's going to go after maybe having adjuvant chemo?
I mean, they're accruing and doesn't look like they're having a huge fall off. So I hope it goes well. And again, most people, after perhaps some initial nausea and then depending on what happens with their counts, a little bit of anemia that declares itself pretty early, most people tolerate the drug very, very well.
You put patients on that study?
No, I haven't actually, not yet. But I know everybody who's enrolling on it.
Just wondering, for example, so they would, for example, be taking tamoxifen and olaparib at the same time.
Yeah.
I guess it would be just set completely independent toxicity.
Yeah. Right.
Although who knows. Why don't we talk about a couple of your cases just real briefly? I was trying to predict how some of these patients got treated. Okay, so 47-year-old woman, 0.9 centimeter grade 2 IDC, ER 95%, PR 50%. HER2 1-2 plus, FISH 2.2, status post bilateral mastectomy. I don't know. I'm going to guess you gave her trastuzumab paclitaxel.
You got it. Exactly. Yeah, APT trial. I mean, the results from that have been so stunningly great for the T1Bs that it's kind of hard to make a case for giving much more than that. So been a fairly standard approach right now for us.
How did she do?
She's doing great. I mean, just got started, so. But you know, as you know, the overall disease-free survival from that study, especially breast cancer-specific survival, is very, very high.
Right. I think they just reported their 7-year results or more follow-up.
Yeah. Sarah Talani reported it at ASCO. Yeah. So I feel it's going to be hard to prove anything to be better than that.
What other regimens do you use in the adjuvant setting for higher risk patients in the HER2 setting?
We are still using anthracycline. So ACTHP is kind of our high risk approach, kind of the affinity approach. Whether or not that changes after affinity, I think we're going to see. I mean, I think there's going to be a little bit of risk stratification that takes place. But
that was going to be my obvious next question, which is your thoughts about affinity. Maybe you can sort of summarize from your own perspective what you think, from your point of view, were the most important findings and, you know, how it affected your practice, if at all.
Well, I think the most important finding is that there wasn't an enormous benefit. I mean, it's a positive trial, of course, so it's hard to be overly negative. But I do think that there's sort of generally a sense of perhaps a wish that things had been better, because it now puts us into this box of trying to decide, is the risk enough to justify the potential incremental toxicity and, of course, financial toxicity? So certainly for higher risk HER2-positive patients, continuing to do that because there is an incremental benefit, and you've got to assume that the absolute benefit's going to be proportional to the baseline risk.
But what were you doing prior to affinity? The former head of breast cancer, Cliff Huddis, who now moved over to ASCO, was kind of, I think, very much involved with the NCCN idea of, you know, if they qualified pre-op, it's okay, or maybe should be done post-op. Were you giving pertuzumab adjuvantly prior to seeing those data?
Yeah, we were doing that. I mean, we've done a lot of neoadjuvant therapy for HER2 patients. And so anybody who kind of was obviously clinically high risk, big tumors, clinical positive nodes, you know, we were getting ACT, HP up front, and then continuing the HP out back. But there was some variability in reimbursement about that, so that often dictated things as well.
Would you say that in general you're going to be continuing to use or using adjuvant pertuzumab for node-positive patients?
I imagine we will. I think especially in younger patients who tolerate it. You know, we certainly do other things for similar degrees of absolute benefit. I mean, breast perhaps is a little bit different than some of the other diseases that way, but I think many patients would consider a 2 to 3% benefit, invasive disease-free survival benefit, to be worth it. And if they started having substantial toxicity, we'd have to readdress. But at least as an initial plan, I think it's hard to back away.
When we're looking at affinity of the node-positive patients, the hazard rate's a little bit better, and you know, it kind of comes together a little bit better. But I don't know if that's the way it's going to actually shake out in practice. I want to ask you about a couple of your other cases just really briefly. Your 65-year-old lady with metastatic ER-positive, HER2-negative disease. And maybe you can talk a little bit about kind of what happened at the point when you saw her. It looks like she was on exemestane, and then you switched her to fulvestrant palbo. Can you talk about that situation, kind of what you were thinking?
So this is a lady who had kind of a long disease-free interval, and also a lot of what was going on with her at the time of relapse was kind of before we had much data about CDK4/6 inhibitors. And so started her on an AI, just kind of fairly conventional. And then when she progressed, changed her to exemestane, she had very minimal progression and was feeling extremely well. And I personally found it hard to swallow the idea of putting her on everolimus and you know, exposing her to the potential toxicities of that. But then when the exemestane didn't work, palbo was coming online, fulvestrant was going to be the natural next thing for her to get anyway. And so we did the two of them together. And so far she's tolerated it. She had some cytopenia, some neutropenia. I had to drop her dose a little bit. And she's had perhaps some slow progression, but been on it for nearly a year now, I guess, and has gotten clinical benefit for sure.
I wanted to ask you about that dose reduction. How often do you end up having to do dose reduction because of neutropenia? When do you monitor patients, and what actually happened with her?
The first time I monitor them at 2 weeks, 4 weeks, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, and just kind of get a sense of what's happening. And she really went in the dumper. I mean, she went down to like 0.1 or something like that. So she clearly needed a dose reduction. She went really low. Other people, I think, have gone, had much less of an issue. But at 100, she's been able to kind of hover her ANC around 1.2, 1.3, and tolerating it fine. I don't know if she had something intercurrent that led her to really go down low at the beginning, but she also actually travels back and forth from Florida, so I don't feel like having her hanging out there with an extremely low white count without me knowing about it, and especially since she's doing well, has low volume disease. I don't really feel that I need to push the dose that hard.
So getting a real flair for this situation. So she's had eczemath stain. Now she's on fulvestrant palbo. If you become convinced that she's progressing and you're still, you know, okay with hormone therapy, what do you think would be next?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I haven't really, the couple of times I have tried everolimus type combinations after CDK4/6 progression, I have not been very impressed. I sort of get the feeling that by the time somebody's kind of gone through a SERD and a CDK4/6 inhibitor, that the HR axis is no longer that critical to their tumor, and you know, be starting to think about capecitabine or something like that if she was in a safe enough place to give an oral agent. I've already tested her, so I know she's not a BRCA carrier. So,
you know what? Oh, she's
I know she's not a BRCA carrier.
She's BRCA negative. And I see, I mean, she had tamoxifen, I guess, as adjuvant therapy. I don't know if that could potentially be a consideration in the future.
Could recycle. I mean, again, I think a lot depends on exactly what is going on with her. If progression is just a little bit more growth of her intramammary node or a little bit more growth of her pleural nodule, I mean, I probably would just continue her on what she's doing. If she started developing other sites or if something felt like the pace of her disease was changing, then I might not feel so good about just going back to tamoxifen and wanting to switch over. So it's almost like a catch-22. If her disease is bad enough to require me to change her therapy, then I kind of really want to change her therapy. I don't want to try something that is less than likely to work.
So speaking of somatic mutations, any comments about estrogen receptor mutations? Have you seen any patients with it? Does it change what you do?
Yeah, we've definitely seen patients with it. It's fascinating. Does it change what I do? No, because usually what winds up happening at our place is we wind up profiling people kind of in the context of their metastatic disease when we've already made our decisions. Personally, I'm pretty impressed with the data, and if I had somebody who had significant ESR mutation, I might be leaning more towards SERDs than to SERMs, but I haven't been using that as a biomarker for treatment determination.
So I think I heard that there's been a, I don't know, the whole thing with androgen receptors and anti-androgens and Tiffany Traina's work, I had actually interviewed her a while back, is not proceeding. Is that the case?
I don't know. I mean, again, getting people interested in it, I mean, it turns out that a lot of triple-negative breast cancer have androgen receptor alterations. I mean, you know, it's not a small subset of patients. And it's been a little hard to get the appropriate trial designs to figure out how do you prove the right way to treat those folks compared to, for instance, the conventional therapy. So I think abandoning that would be a disappointment just because it's such a potentially significant pathway. And many of those folks have fairly indolent disease, and if we could treat them with an oral agent, oral antiandrogen, as opposed to knee-jerking into chemotherapy for everybody who has triple negative, I think it would be a service to them.
I think I just heard that mantle cell lymphoma has androgen receptors, too.
Well, there you go.
Well, I know they've tried CDK4/6 inhibitors with mantle cell, but I don't know if that's connected. Anyhow,
you know, anything that has an RB pathway alteration is something
right.
You want to look at.
So maybe we can also hear about your 54-year-old lady get into another issue, which is the issue of genomic profiling on the ER-positive, HER2-negative situation. What happened with this lady?
Yeah, so she was an interesting lady because she had tiny primaries and then she had axillary nodal metastases. And also there was an overlay of patient preference here where she really didn't want to get chemotherapy unless she absolutely had to. And so this was shortly after the 70-gene assay had kind of had its publication and been approved. And so I thought, well, let me see if just by chance she has a low genomic risk score, in which case perhaps we can make a little bit more of an argument or provide her some data to help her make her decision about chemo. And she didn't. I mean, she had a high score, which made me more confident in the conventional recommendation to treat her. But it was just a way to essentially help inform patient decision making in that setting.
So she decided to get chemo?
Yeah, she did. She was fine. I mean, she was a sensible lady. She wanted to avoid it if at all possible, but wasn't refractory. If she'd been negative, I mean, if she'd had a low genomic score, it would have been tough. I mean, because micrometastatic disease in one node, yes, she had a macromet in the other, but it was only 9 millimeters, and then these tiny primaries within the breast. Her, you know, pretest risk prediction would have probably been pretty small. And so committing her to certainly anthracycline-based chemotherapy in that setting would have been tough in terms of risk-benefit.
What do you think would happen if we presented this case to 25 breast cancer investigators and said, would you order a genomic assay in this patient? If so, which one? What do you think they would say?
You get three different answers.
I mean, well, actually, I can tell you, you get two answers.
Yeah.
Neither of which is what you did, incidentally. Just want to point out, which is because we actually did that survey at Abstract at ASCO on this. So what we found is that half of the investigators are using 21 gene recurrence score, node positive, particularly low volume axillary, you know, one node in particular, and the others don't use anything, but none of them use the 70 gene assay, which you used in this case. What was your thinking in doing that as opposed to the 21 gene?
I just feel like, you know, the 21 gene assay in the node positive disease just has so much less in the way of validation. I mean, we're still waiting for our responder, and until that comes out, just the data hooking onto the SWOG trial just doesn't feel good to me. And sure, if they have a low score, then that's potentially reassuring. But so many of these wind up being intermediate, and then that wouldn't really have gotten me anywhere. And so the MINDAC data for me, I understand the concerns that it hasn't excluded a benefit of chemotherapy in low genomic, high risk, high clinical. I get that. But on the other hand, it does suggest that the benefit of chemotherapy in that setting is going to be less. And if that's the case, in this particular scenario where the lady was already kind of biased against it, I personally would have felt pretty comfortable just giving her hormone therapy alone in that setting.
Interesting. I thought, you know, globally, the thing that I found most interesting about the survey, and I don't know, did you take it? Because I know we send you stuff all the time, but you must not have been in there because nobody answered 70 gene, although, you know, maybe it was individual for this patient. But the thing
I'm okay with a 70 gene assay for node positive disease. I know that the vibe has not been particularly enthusiastic, but it seems like at least it was validated in a big data set.
Absolutely. And I think the vibe is just more, well, we're used to the 21 gene is not a gigantic reason to change kind of thing, rather than, you know, it's not valid, but kind of like, well, we've already got used to using Palbo. I don't know. I thought globally the thing that was most interesting, though, about it, the survey that we did, and we knew this was going to happen because we ask people all the time. We know people are split about it. But the thing that was amazing is, you know, you have this ASCO guideline statement out there saying, do not do a genomic assay in a patient who has a positive node. Mm-hmm. And then you've got half the investigators who are doing it. And it's just, you read that paper, you don't get. We did a piece about this, and actually a very prominent member of that committee contacted me and gave me a long list of why they put that in there. He didn't want to publish, but I totally understand it. But I just think it's amazing that there's a guideline out there, and yet a lot of investigators are not following it, including you.
Yeah, including me. I mean, I think this is a case where you're trying to give patients information to help them make decisions. And I think, you know, would it have been wrong to have given this lady chemotherapy if she had a low genomic risk score or even if she had a low oncotype score? No, I don't think it would have been wrong. But certainly in terms of her own decision making, having an additional test to support the idea that she needed to be treated was helpful to her. It gave her that additional confidence that this was the right decision and the motivation to go through the toxicity of what she's going through.
So let's finish out with your last case, getting back to PARP inhibitors. And maybe you could just briefly talk about this 49-year-old lady.
This is just to show that, you know, this is unfortunately not a panacea, right? This is a lovely lady. She's really just a lovely, lovely lady who had metastatic triple-negative breast cancer and came to see me after progressing through CAPE to go on the Olympiad and got started on olaparib and had a pretty decent initial response and then lost it pretty quickly. I mean, she started and then failed and unfortunately failed platinum after that and then failed a series of other things and passed away relatively quickly. So I think it's more just that we still, as enthusiastic as I am, as exciting as it is to have this sort of therapy that makes biologic sense and does provide benefit and does provide benefit, sometimes it's quite prolonged, it still means that we got a long way to go. And, you know, we need to continue to do research. We need to continue to do the biologic research that allowed us to develop the root therapy in the first place and to understand the mechanisms of resistance and to try to improve the outcomes.